Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be in the listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, to ask a question, dial star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to introduce your host, Mr. Tom Chiller. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining us on such short notice. Today's CDC webinar is going to discuss some recent data in the ongoing fungal meningitis and other infections outbreak and what their implications are for the treatment and management of patients exposed to contaminated lots of steroid injections from the New England Compounding Center. My name is Tom Chiller. I'm a medical epidemiologist and the deputy branch chief of the Mycotic Diseases Branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And I will be providing a real brief overview of CDC's recent Health Alert Network update, which should be going out today. Following this overview, we'll hear from our colleagues, Drs. Malani and Katsotakis, who are both physicians at St. Joseph's Mercy Medical Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and have been dealing with many of the patients in this outbreak throughout the last several months. They are going to present a series of cases that will highlight the current clinical presentations, diagnostic findings, and treatment strategies for these infections. Once we've heard from our presenters, we will open the line for a question and answer session. During the presentations, please make sure your phone lines are on mute, and we will take questions again after the presentations are complete. So I now want to just briefly mention, as I talk to you about the agenda today, we're going to look at an overview of the CDC health update. We're going to then hear presentations of clinical case findings and strategies for treatment from Anu Malani and Michael Katsotakis from St. Joseph's Mercy, and then we're going to have the Q&A session. Just to highlight some of the new findings that we've been discussing and working on with states in this outbreak. There has been new data provided that has shown evidence that a substantial proportion of patients have developed localized or focal infections at the site of injection following exposure to the contaminated steroid injections that we've been talking about and that are associated with this outbreak. The signs and symptoms of these spinal and paraspinal infections can be very subtle and difficult to distinguish from the patient's baseline chronic pain. So we want clinicians to consider obtaining an MRI for patients with persistent but baseline symptoms. And it's important that this decision be made on a case-by-case basis after discussion between the clinician and patient and taking into account the patient's history regarding past and current systems. This is a summary of the health advisory that's going to come out later today, and we encourage you to go to our website listed here on this slide to get a more detailed overview of these recommendations. Now I would like to again introduce Dr. Malani and Dr. Katsotakis, who will tag team the following cases that will be presented to illustrate treatment and management issues. Anu?
Thanks, Tom. At St. Joseph Mercy Hospital Ann Arbor, we've seen well over 165 cases of fungal infections associated with the contaminated methylprednisolone injections. While the early cases primarily presented as meningitis, for the last 6 to 7 weeks, we have primarily been seeing patients with paraspinal and epidural infections. I want to highlight 5 cases that illustrate the various presentations we are now seeing. Case 1 will be a parameningeal infection. Case 2 will be related to an epidural abscess. Case 3 will be an epidural/paraspinal abscess with minimal symptoms. Case 4 will be vertebral osteomyelitis and discitis. And case 5 will be sacroiliac osteomyelitis. So starting with the case of pyrimeningeal infection. Here are the key points of this case. In terms of diagnosis, pyrimeningeal infection is a potential complication of fungal meningitis and may occur despite medical therapy. An MRI of the epidural injection site is indicated in patients presenting with fungal meningitis and probably should be completed 2 to 3 weeks after presentation. MRI findings can be difficult to interpret in the postoperative setting and may lag behind clinical improvement. In terms of treatment, a prolonged course of liposomal amphotericin or amphotericin may be necessary in some cases of arachnoiditis. Case 1. This was a 72-year-old female with a history of a contaminated L3-L4 epidural injection. Her chief complaint was 1 week of headache, neck stiffness, chills, and fatigue 15 days after her injection. Her lumbar puncture showed 549 white blood cells and confirmed a diagnosis of meningitis, although the PCR was negative for fungal DNA. Medical treatment was initiated with voriconazole combined with liposomal amphotericin for 5 days. Her clinical symptoms improved, and she was discharged 26 days after her injection and continued on oral voriconazole as an outpatient. Unfortunately, the patient returned to the hospital 36 days after her injection with a chief complaint of back pain and lower extremity weakness. I will now ask Dr. Mike Kasatakis, a neuroradiologist from her hospital, to interpret her MRI findings.
Okay. Thank you, Anu. I'm going to show you a series of two slides showing the lumbar spine MRI images on this patient. On the first slide, you can see my arrow here pointed on the left is a T1 sagittal post-contrast image, and you can see there's an area of kind of bulky mass-like enhancement within the dorsal aspect of the sac at approximate level of L3-L4. To the right of that is a similar post-contrast image, but this one is with fat suppression. You can see much more clearly the area of abnormal enhancement. Now, it's sort of hard to tell if it's epidural or intraspinal, but on the next slide here, this is a representative axial image through the area of interest. And you can see the arrow and my arrow is pointing to an area of enhancement that is clearly intradural and basically representing clumping and enhancement of the nerve roots of the cauda equina.
Thanks, Mike. Given these MRI findings, our neurosurgeons performed an evacuation of the epidural abscess and an L3 laminectomy. Intraoperatively, they described phlegmon-like material adherent to clumping nerve roots and a small amount of pus. This is an intraoperative image from a patient with a similar presentation showing the thecal sac with visible phlegmon. Pathology from the intradural abscess showed purulent inflammation on H&E stain in the top right-hand corner and fungal hyphae on GMS stain. Given these operative and pathology findings, the patient was restarted on voriconazole and amphotericin and continued combination therapy for 5 weeks. She had a follow-up MRI 62 days after injection, which showed stable arachnoiditis with intradural involvement and postoperative changes and enhancement at the laminectomy site. At 71 days after injection, her symptoms had improved sufficiently for discharge, and she is now continuing treatment on oral voriconazole as an outpatient. To summarize the key points of this case, in regards to diagnosis, pyrimeningeal infection is a potential complication of fungal meningitis and may occur despite medical therapy. An MRI of the epidural injection site is indicated in patients presenting with fungal meningitis and probably should be completed 2 to 3 weeks after presentation. MRI findings can be difficult to interpret in the postoperative setting and may lag behind clinical improvement. A prolonged course of amphotericin may be necessary in some cases of arachnoiditis. The next case I will discuss is an epidural abscess. The key diagnostic points here are that epidural abscesses can develop many weeks after a contaminated methylprednisolone injection, Therefore, you should maintain a low threshold for ordering an MRI in patients with persistent, worse, or new symptoms. In regards to treatment, neurosurgical consultation is critical when evaluating and treating epidural and paraspinal abscesses. An optimal treatment duration and selection for epidural abscesses is unknown. Case 2 is a 47-year-old female or male who received a contaminated C6-C7 epidural injection. He presented repeatedly after his injection with the chief complaint of headache, confusion, malaise, neck pain, and spasms. During the 30 days after his injection, he had 3 unremarkable lumbar punctures. And also during this time, he had 3 unremarkable cervical MRIs. A 4th MRI was ordered 42 days or 6 weeks after his injection, which Mike will discuss.
Good, thank you, Anu. I'm going to show you a series of 2 slides. On the first slide here, we have 2 MR images through the cervical spine that are separated in time. On the left, you can see it's 31 days after injection, and on the right, 42 days. The MRI 31 days after injection, this is a post-contrast central T1, which is negative. And then on 42 days, you can see the arrow, and my arrow is pointing to an area of abnormal enhancement, which has a lentiform appearance consistent with an epidural location. On the following slide, again, you see the two MRs. They're T2-weighted images, and you can see the collection on the right that's developed 42 days after injection within the epidural space. The findings are consistent with a cervical epidural abscess or phlegmon.
Thanks, Mike. Given these MRI findings, our neurosurgeons performed an evacuation of the epidural abscess and C5 to C7 laminectomy. Abscess and pus were visualized intraoperatively. Pathology from the epidural abscess showed acute inflammation next to a bony spicule on H&E stain and rare fungal hyphae on GMS stain in the right hand bottom corner. The patient was then medically treated with voriconazole and amphotericin for 10 days. His symptoms improved, and he was discharged 57 days after his injection and continues on oral voriconazole. To summarize, the key diagnostic points are that epidural abscesses and paraspinal abscesses can develop many weeks after contaminated methylprednisolone injections. Therefore, you should maintain a low threshold for ordering an MRI in patients with persistent, worse, or new symptoms. In regards to treatment, neurosurgical consultation is critical when evaluating and treating epidural and paraspinal abscesses. An optimal treatment duration for epidural abscesses is unknown. Now I will present case 3, an epidural abscess with minimal symptoms. The key points in this case, first, patients with minimal or baseline symptoms may harbor epidural and paraspinal infection. Therefore, you should maintain a low threshold for ordering an MRI in these patients. And finally, operative findings may not always correlate with microbiology or pathology results. Case 3 was a 43-year-old female who received a contaminated L3 to L4 and L4 to L5 epidural injection 34 days apart. She presented to her physician complaining of lower back pain, which was similar to her baseline pain, which she rated as 3 out of 10. She had a lumbar puncture 12 days after her last injection, which showed a white blood cell count of 1, and not consistent with meningitis. She underwent a lumbar MRI 41 days after her last injection, and Mike will go over her MRI.
Okay, thanks, Anu. I'm going to show you one slide here, a series of 4 images. In the left upper hand, you can see the arrow pointing to the right L4-L5 neural foramen, and this is a contrast but a fat-suppressed image, so you can see this bright area here which represents abnormal enhancement. For the right of that, you can see the arrows pointing to the right neural foramen at the same level, and you can see there's asymmetry in the fat. Here's normal fat surrounding the nerve root here, but here there's abnormal enhancing soft tissue. Here's the same slice right here in the sagittal plane. You can see some enhancement at the disc margins here. In the lower right-hand corner, You can see a parasagittal. This is a non-contrast image. So you can see normal white fat surrounding the exiting nerve roots above and below the area of abnormality. But within the foramen on the right here, you can see some what I call fuzzy soft tissue, which effaces the fat surrounding the nerve root. These findings are concerning for neuroforaminal and paraspinal phlegma.
Thanks, Mike. Given these MRI findings, our neurosurgeons performed a right L4, L5 laminectomy, a medial facetectomy, with foraminotomy of the L4 root. No abscess or pus was seen intraoperatively. However, anatomic pathology showed an L4, L5 epidural fungal abscess. Pathology from the paraspinal abscess showed acute inflammation with pigmented septate hyphae fragments. The patient was medically treated with voriconazole and amphotericin, and she symptomatically improved by 52 days after her injection. She was discharged on oral voriconazole. To summarize, patients with minimal or baseline symptoms may harbor epidural and paraspinal infections. Therefore, one should maintain a low threshold for ordering an MRI in these patients. And finally, operative findings may not always correlate with microbiology or pathology results. Now I will present a case of vertebral osteomyelitis and discitis. The key points here are that osteomyelitis and discitis are potential late complications of contaminated methylprednisolone injections. A proactive outreach may help identify patients earlier in their course. In regards to treatment, a surgical consultation is critical for evaluating and treating osteomyelitis. Case 4 was a 28-year-old female who had a contaminated L4, L5 epidural injection. She presented with a chief complaint of 3 weeks of left lower extremity weakness 90 days after her injection. She had previously undergone a lumbar puncture at an outside hospital 20 days prior, which was normal. An MRI was performed on this presentation, which is shown on the next slides. Mike?
Thank you, Anu. I'm going to show you a series of two slides here. On the first one, on the left is a sagittal stir image through the area of abnormality, and on the right is the post-contrast fat suppressed image. You can clearly see that there's abnormal bone marrow edema within the L4 and L5 vertebral bodies and abnormal signal intensity within the L4-L5 intervertebral disc. To the right of midline here, you can see that this floridly enhances following contrast administration, and there's also enhancement and irregularity of the vertebral body end plates. The next slide, I'm going to show you two side-by-side images. On the left is the pre-contrast T1 through the area of abnormality, and on the right is the contrast image. You can see that there's florid paravertebral enhancement surrounding the disc space. There's also enhancement within the disc and within the ventral epidural space. This is a classic case of discitis osteomyelitis.
Thanks, Mike. Because of these radiology findings, the patient underwent an L4, L5 microdiscectomy with irrigation and debridement of scar tissue on the L5 nerve root. Pathology showed fungal hyphae and GMS stain and chronic inflammation. Microbiology confirmed the presence of mold, which has yet to be speciated. The patient has been medically treated with voriconazole and amphotericin. She is still hospitalized, but her symptoms have improved and will probably be discharged later this week, about 107 days after her last injection. She will continue on oral voriconazole as an outpatient. In summary, osteomyelitis and discitis are potential late complications of contaminated methylprednisolone injections. A proactive outreach may help identify patients earlier in their course. In regards to treatment, surgical consultation is critical for evaluating and treating osteomyelitis. Now I will present the last case, a case of sacroiliac osteomyelitis. The key diagnostic points for this case: our sacroiliac osteomyelitis is a potential complication of contaminated sacroiliac injections. Therefore, one should maintain a low threshold for ordering an MRI in patients exposed to contaminated sacroiliac injections. In regards to treatment, criteria for surgical intervention are not clear. Case 5 is a 60-year-old female who had a contaminated right sacroiliac joint injection. She presented with a chief complaint of progressive right-sided pain and difficulty ambulating. An MRI was performed 44 days after injection, and Michael presented radiographic findings.
Thank you, Anu. I'm going to show you one slide with a series of three images. Where my arrow is pointing to is the fat-suppressed post-contrast image, and you can see where the level of the right sacroiliac joint. You can see the abnormality is centered at the level of the joint, but also involves the subjacent sacrum and ilium. You can see up here in the left upper-hand corner that there's abnormal signal intensity manifest by this bright signal involving the bony surface. In the lower right-hand corner is the P1 non-contrast image to show you how there's normal marrow here filled with fat, but abnormal marrow here secondary to the edema. This is a case of septic sacroiliitis.
Thank you, Mike. Given these radiographic findings, our orthopedic surgeons performed an arthrotomy and debridement and iliac crest bone biopsy. Intraoperatively, they noticed a small amount of purulent fluid. Pathology findings from the iliac crest biopsy showed neutrophil and plasma cell infiltration next to bony spicules, consistent with osteomyelitis. Microbiology confirmed the presence of exorhilum. The patient was medically treated with IV voriconazole, and the patient's symptoms improved to the point where she was discharged 58 days after her injection. She has continued on voriconazole as an outpatient. To summarize this case, remember that sacroiliac osteomyelitis is a potential complication of contaminated sacroiliac injections. Again, one should maintain a low threshold for imaging or an MRI in patients exposed to contaminated sacroiliac injections. And the criteria for surgical intervention on sacroiliac osteomyelitis is not clear. In conclusion, paramenangial infections, epidural abscesses, vertebral osteomyelitis with discitis, and sacroiliac osteomyelitis are potential complications of contaminated methylprednisolone injections. Proactive outreach may help identify patients earlier in their course. Therefore, one should maintain a low threshold to order imaging and an MRI with and without contrast at the spinal or paraspinal injection site in patients with persistent, worse, or new symptoms. Early surgical consultation is essential for management of spinal or paraspinal infections. And finally, the optimal duration of medical treatment for these infections is not yet known. I'd like to acknowledge the following persons for their contributions. And thank you.
Thanks, Anu and Mike, for that great summary of cases, and again, for all your hard work in dealing with these complicated patients over the last several months. And we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to be here with us today, and with the clinical community that's been able to join. I want to just remind everybody that there are two different ways to ask questions. You can type in a question via the live meeting website that you're logged into now, and we here at CDC can receive that question and can respond to it in this webinar. And then secondly, the operator will also be able to queue you up and take calls on the phone line directly. So as you're hopefully getting ready to ask some questions, I'd like to start with the first question, and Mike, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I think all of us appreciate the challenges in getting MRIs and reading MRIs, especially in this particular outbreak, and given the fact that the health advisory that has just come out and the health alert that's just come out actually from us today at CDC, that that really tells patients and clinicians to have a very low threshold to get an MRI at the spinal, paraspinal areas that are affected or that were injected. I just thought I would give you a chance, Mike, to comment on your experience with MRIs and whether there are a few take-home messages or thoughts that you could give us about reading these MRIs as abnormal, and whether there were things that we should be looking for or asking about.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Tom. Thank you so much. You know, as you alluded to, it really is a, you know, large, multidisciplinary, concerted effort. It's going to take multiple, you know, facilities of the hospital to bring such a program together. You know, here in Michigan, we, you know, got authority from the state of Michigan to bring in a new MRI scanner to address capacity issues. We're a CON state, a certificate of need state. So once you get that in line and you address those capacity issues, the next step is, you know, finding the qualified readers to read these, reading them in a timely manner, having a consistent, unified vernacular on what disease means and how we classify it, and then knowing who to disseminate the results to. And here at St. Joe's, we were very successful at that because we did have a multidisciplinary team approach. We had almost daily meetings. We had a fungal outbreak clinic where we as radiologists could contact, that we as radiologists could send the results to immediately. Given that, we basically guaranteed them a 24/7, 365, one-hour turnaround time on these reads. So it was really a multidisciplinary concerted effort. And it's an evolving process, too. We were lucky in that although we are a private practice radiology group, we're not an academic institution, we are very subspecialized. And, Tom, what that means is that all these neuro, all these spines and MRIs were read by neuroradiologists. So we did have the comfort level when it comes to specialization. And we, you know, it was a learning process. There was a lot of consultation between colleagues. There was a lot of evolution. There was a lot of RadPath correlation. There were conferences where, you know, we discussed this with the ID docs and the surgeons to provide pretty quick feedback so we could gauge our sensitivity, okay? And we sort of, you know, oscillated on the balance between being, you know, too sensitive or not as sensitive. And because what really happened here is, and Anu can discuss this too, is once we started this screening program, which we may talk about later, you know, MRI really became, you know, where the buck stopped. You know, for the first time, as I know, MRI was used as a screening study. And that really brought up a lot of unknowns and new areas that we had to address. Because as you know, there was a plethora of information on these MR images, some of which may or may not pertain to fungal disease. And we came up with so-called, you know, equivocal findings. And whether or not it was related to true fungal disease or not, we weren't sure. The only thing we could do, at least in radiology, was to recommend a follow-up examination. So there were quite a bit of patients that underwent follow-up. So it's not only the initial screening MR, but it's the follow-ups that go with that. And it's having a really a tight group where you can provide feedback across disciplines and evolve as readers and clinicians is really key to this.
Great. Thanks, Mike, and thanks for explaining some of the logistics and putting this together. And I think we'll probably have time to, I'm sure there'll be some more questions about radiology. While we're waiting for people to queue up on the phone, I think we have received a couple questions here at CDC via the live meeting. So maybe we'll go ahead and read those, and then we'll take those first couple questions. Ray, do you want to?
Sure. So the first question would probably be fielded for Anu. What is your experience in collecting microbiology samples, PCR samples, intraoperatively? In my experience, many of the LP samples, fungal cultures, and PCR are negative. are intraoperative tissue sample studies more likely to result in positive results?
So we saw about 53 cases of meningitis, and you know, many more cases of paraspinal and epidural related infections. I would say that first thing is that there's definitely a higher proportion or a higher degree of positive cultures from the epidural and paraspinal cases. In terms of the meningitis patients, it's really a minority of them that had positive cultures. I can count them on one hand, so it's only a few. In terms of molecular testing in that group, it's probably, it was about maybe 15 or so. And it did not always correlate to level of pleocytosis. I mean, we had patients with as low as, 20 to 50 cells that had positive molecular testing. In regards to what we've really seen the last 6 to 7 weeks, you know, the epidural and paraspinal infections, it seems that these patients have a much higher degree of positive cultures. Also positive path, meaning that, you know, as seen in a couple of these cases we presented, that they actually had evidence of fungi and histopath. As far as PCR from these tissues, we are still getting results on some of those tissue samples. Frankly, if they had mold growing or they had evidence of fungi on histopath, I'm not sure that we always sent the tissues for PCR. I think maybe I wonder if Tom can comment a little bit on PCRs in that setting, because I think we still are maybe waiting to get back some of those tissues.
Thanks, Anu. I think it's important to note that PCR and culture for fungi in general are not a very sensitive test, and so we know that that many people who truly do have infections will still not have a PCR or a culture positive. I think that we are working on our tissue PCR. Here at CDC, we are able to PCR fungi from tissue, but this is a challenging and more of an experimental test. But we are, in this outbreak, trying to do that and have had some success, and so we continue to work on that. And we'll be happy to continue to receive tissues from suspected patients to try to perform PCR. So let's move on to the next question. We'll take one more from the internet, and then we'll go to the phone lines.
Yes, there's a question here. Do you have any ideas about identifying these infections in patients with implantable devices that make MRI if they're not able to get an MRI because of some kind of implantable device? Sorry, I think I mangled that question, but I think it's a question for Mike.
Yep, no, I got it. Thank you. That's a really good question. So first of all, I want to say that by far and away, MRI with contrast is the gold standard for diagnosing this disease. But there are patients, as you mentioned, that cannot receive MRI due to contraindications. Those include patients with pacemakers and patients with bladder or spinal stimulators. What we've done is we have experience with that. We've tried to do CT with contrast. And we have a case in particular where we did a CT in a patient with a spinal stimulator, and the CT didn't show any infection, or at least, you know, couldn't identify anything. We thought that was clinically necessary based on the risk and benefits. After discussion with the neurosurgeon, we actually he removed the stimulator. Then we put the patient into the MRI scanner with contrast and found positive disease, okay? So it may be very important to have that difficult discussion. We have not yet had any patients with pacemakers, ironically, although we are under clinical trials that allow us to scan patients with pacemakers in a controlled setting with the cardiologist. Finally, the role of nuclear medicine like gallium scanning is really minimal, and we haven't done it at our institution. The test is pretty sensitive and nonspecific. And then one more point is that, you know, if all bets are off, if the patient cannot get in the machine, I would certainly do the CT scan with contrast, because we have diagnosed disease on CT, although, again, it's less sensitive than MRI, especially in bigger patients where there's a lot of
paraspinal fat, and what happens is that the disease, the infection, the fungus, fills in the fat, and you get asymmetry of the fat, and we have UCT to diagnose it. So MRI if you can with contrast. If you can't, CT, and then if you really need to consider working with the surgeons to address the stimulators and pacemakers. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Operator, can we go to the phone lines if there's anyone queued up?
Yes, thank you. And as a reminder, to ask a question over the phone, dial star, then one. We have a question on phone waiting. Dr. Stephen Piles, your line's open. Please check your mute button. Dr. Stephen Piles, your line's open.
Perhaps go to the next question.
We do have another question queuing. One moment.
We can take one quickly then through the internet while we're waiting for that questioner to queue up.
Yes,
go ahead, Ray.
All right. So, next question over the internet, is the incidence of localized infection similar in Tennessee and Virginia?
So this is Tom Chiller at the CDC, and I think I'll take that question. And I think that you can see on our recent updates to the webpage for numbers of cases that right now the majority of paraspinal and spinal infections are in Michigan and Tennessee. And partly this could be due to geographic differences in the way this disease is presenting that are unclear to us right now for the exact reasons and risks, but there could be geographical differences in presentation. And there also could be differences in the aggressivity of clinicians approaching patients that have very minimal symptoms, if not symptoms the same as their baseline symptoms. And that is one of the reasons, based on the preliminary data that we have from Michigan, Tennessee, and North Carolina, that we have put out the health advisory today that strongly encourages clinicians and patients to evaluate the pain and consider obtaining an MRI in order to diagnose localized infections that may be very subtle clinically. So, operator, could we take, is there a question on the phone?
We do have a couple more questions over the phone. Our first question comes from James Mulner. Your line's open.
Hi. Thanks for all for putting together this seminar, by the way. I actually have a series of questions, but the first one is probably, we've been, again, still working with voriconazole serum levels and improving our turnaround time, but just wondering if other people have seen an adequate response rate with levels in the 1 to 2 serum range as opposed to pushing them up between 2 and 5 as some of the CDC notation represents. And we've been doing dual therapy with amphotericin B as well during this whole time period.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Anu, do you want to give your thoughts and experience?
Sure. So, you know, we've seen kind of voriconazole troughs all across the spectrum. It seems that when we started people initially, we saw quite a number of people with elevated troughs and often back down on the dose. And it seems like more lately the trend with increased amount of time that patients have been on voriconazole, we've actually seen troughs on the lower end, and they seem to be tolerating a little bit better. I think generally we've tried to tolerate troughs between 2 and 5.
Okay.
Some people, if they didn't, you know, if they had arachnoiditis and it was pretty severe, I think we've erred on the side of maybe even a little bit higher as long as they're tolerating it well, you know, maybe even the low 5s. In patients that also had osteomyelitis, like sacroiliac osteomyelitis, we've seen a number of those cases, vertebral osteomyelitis, almost the same. We've maybe even erred on the side of being a little bit higher as long as they're tolerating it well. I mean, we have had several patients that have had low troughs of late that we've kind of struggled with in terms of how to bring their troughs up. I think turnaround time has been an issue for us. It definitely was an issue very early on where we weren't getting troughs back probably, you know, for 5 to 7 days, and sometimes those were delayed on the weekends. Our lab testing is done through the Mayo Clinic, and so the turnaround time is anywhere from 2 to 3 days to 5 to 6 days. It just kind of depends on when it happens, because I think they end up batching tests Monday through Friday, and sometimes if you do a trough on Thursday or Friday, it takes a little bit longer to come back. And I would add that, you know, for a couple of the peripheral joint infections, I had one patient who really had significant LT elevation, probably 10 times normal, that didn't really seem to go away. She's on itraconazole, doing really well, seemed to be tolerating it okay. And I think we also have a shoulder and an ankle type infection that are both on itraconazole.
Okay. Well, that was helpful. Thank you. In follow-up, what are you using as a criteria when you feel it's safe to discharge patients home? We have one gal who really has done remarkably well, good levels on IV, now off of amphotericin less than a week, and the abscess or phlegmon, intradural it seems to be, has diminished in size by probably anywhere from 40 to 60% depending on how you measure it. But are you guys having any particular criteria that you're using when you're willing to change them to from IV to oral? And are you doing that as a slow transition or just making the leap? And are there other criteria you're using to ensure that you don't have the patient coming back now that we've gotten this kind of intermediate term improvement? She's now at probably 6 weeks here in the hospital.
And she has did she have meningitis before?
She had no meningitis symptoms, increasing low back pain, and that the first MRI at week 3.5 was entirely normal, and within 2 weeks later presented with worsening back pain that the MRI was very positive.
And so it sounds like kind of no surgical intervention?
No surgery yet, no.
So it almost sounds like arachnoiditis.
Correct. That's what she seems to have, with a dense sort of adhesion at one level and some slight enhancement on the caudi region ascending.
So I guess I would say a couple comments on that. Is one, in terms of how long we treated patients for, I think it depended on what type of infection they had,
mm-hmm.
and whether or not they underwent operative intervention. For a case like that, we saw several cases of arachnoiditis. I would say that many of them did not undergo operative intervention because there really wasn't a epidural component to their infection.
Mm-hmm.
And that... many of these patients actually, their symptoms improved. Actually, I mean, almost all of these patients improved with time. Many of them received long courses of combination therapy, 4 to 5 weeks. And I think what we kind of try to do internally amongst myself and three other ID partners who are primarily seeing these patients as well, we try to treat these types of patients, those with arachnoiditis, for about 4 weeks with combination therapy. I think you have to realize that the MRI is often difficult to interpret, does not change. But if they're clinically doing better, we also felt that, you know, the IV, we're using IV ambisome here, was also difficult to tolerate for a long period of time. The potassium wasting, the magnesium wasting, the significant renal effects, the IV hydration. We had people gaining 30 or 40 pounds of fluid because we were hydrating so aggressively. It was really hard to take after beyond that period.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of those that had, you know, that didn't have arachnoiditis or intradural involvement, that had epidural or paraspinal infection, and they underwent operative intervention, we were treating many of those patients with combination therapy for anywhere from 7 to 10 days and then discharging them on oral voriconazole. In terms of the transition, mm-hmm. I would say that if you have a level back, probably can transition them right away, and especially if the level's okay, given the bioavailability. And that may also help in terms of when they're getting ready for discharge, so you're not waiting to see if they can tolerate it or if they have nausea or things like that. So I think, you know, we didn't always do that initially on, but I think the trend more so probably in the last, you know, month to 6 weeks is we were probably transitioning people to oral voriconazole much sooner, especially when we had levels back.
Okay.
Thanks, Anu. And James, thanks. I hope you don't have more. I want to cut you off just so we give.
That's fine. No, I'm done. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, James. I really appreciate it. Operator, queue up another person. In the meantime, we'll ask one internet question.
All right. So this next question, what is the time frame for treatment in patients with meningitis? Is it still 3 months if they've started doing well on treatment? And how are patients doing off of treatment?
So thanks for that question. And I guess I'll start anew, and then I'll give you a chance to respond as well. Obviously, duration of treatment has been an issue that all of us have been thinking about since the beginning of these infections. And I think that as we're learning more about how patients are doing, and as we're hearing about different manifestations of disease, I think we're probably going to have different lengths of therapy based on severity and location of disease. For example, I think we all know that osteomyelitis due to fungus requires lengthy therapy, usually a year, if not longer. I think that some of the arachnoiditis patients, or maybe all of them, will also require lengthy therapy and that will potentially go months to a year. But I think that the optimal duration for these various conditions is still unknown. And I think that as we as a clinical community begin to feel comfortable that our patients are improving and then maybe push that therapy a little bit longer and begin stopping, we'll probably learn, unfortunately, more about whether that was a sufficient therapy or not. Anu, do you have any specific comments from your experience?
Yeah, I agree with what you said, Tom. I think that it's going to treatment duration is going to depend on probably what bucket of spectrum or disease you have. And those that have arachnoiditis, those that have vertebral osteomyelitis, sacroiliac osteomyelitis, probably most of our patients that had meningitis, they all presented, over two-thirds of them represented with infection at their epidural site. Many of those were operated on. And I think that even those patients are going to require a long course of therapy. Many of those patient presentations were on oral voriconazole. So we here, at least in Ann Arbor, have not really done repeat spinal taps yet. There are, I think, other centers that are doing that. And I think, as Tom alluded to earlier, there are probably different geographic, depending on where you are in the country, you may be seeing a different type of disease. But I think that those answers are not yet known. And then the other thing I would add, even in the epidural and paraspinal infections, I think that surgical intervention is probably, our feeling here is that this is probably something that really has a strong role in these patients, and that that may play a role in how long you treat patients as well. Maybe those patients can undergo a shorter course of therapy.
Thanks, Anu. And again, a challenging issue, duration of therapy, but I think one that we will continually address with our clinical experts and with people like Anu out there treating these patients, and we'll try to give some guidance when we learn more information. Why don't we see, operator, is there anyone queued up on the phone? We can take a phone question.
We do have a couple in queue. Dr. Farks, your line's open.
Yes, I have a question here. Why is it that we're seeing more localized disease now? And initially we're seeing more meningitis.
Yeah, thanks for that question. And I think we're asking the same thing of ourselves and of the clinical community. It does seem that if we look back now at the prior 3 months or so that we've been in this outbreak, in the initial stage or the initial days, there were very severe, very severely ill patients presenting. Many of them had strokes. Some of them died, unfortunately. And then as we gained knowledge that there were contaminated injections, and as we mounted a public health response, We brought back in hundreds, if not thousands, of patients to be reevaluated. Many of them had lumbar punctures, as you all know, were diagnosed with meningitis based on the lumbar puncture findings, and those cases with meningitis were quite diverse. So we had cases that had very few cells in their CSF to cases with many cells. But I think in general there were meningitis cases that were not as severely ill as some of the first initial cases. And now, as you've just heard, over the last month or so, the majority of patients that are presenting and that we're diagnosing as part of this outbreak do have these focal infections. Of course, as you heard Anu mention, in his experience and in experiences from some other clinics and states, a large proportion of those initial meningitic cases did develop a focal infection at the site of injection concurrently or slightly delayed to when their meningitis was diagnosed. So that is sort of the look of the clinical disease that we've seen in this outbreak. But specifically to address the issue of why certain people have localized infections and why this late, I think would be challenging. And I think that the pathophysiology of this disease and of this infection is something we are grappling with and trying to learn about as we go, since the unprecedented nature of this particular outbreak and the fact that fungus was injected with a steroid into a sterile space, allowing for minimal inflammation to initially occur, probably presents some sort of complication into how the pathophysiology of different people progressed. So suffice it to say, I don't think we have a very good answer for that question, although it is a great question, and I think we still continue to consider different options, and I don't want to theorize on this call, but I do think it presents a very interesting clinical syndrome.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Okay, one follow-up.
Yeah, that's going to be significant, given that patients will be having residual back pain from their underlying initial pathology while they initially received the steroid injection. And if you consider to repeat imaging, the whole issue of artifacts from their previous pathology and artifacts from scarring from the surgical intervention that they had done. So seeing more localized disease, I'm seeing where it's going to make the decision when to stop voriconazole even more difficult.
I think you present two very important points, and you're absolutely correct. You understood the first one being the pain that they initially received the injection for is clearly complicating our ability to diagnose patients with a subsequent infection clinically, which is why you heard today and why we're recommending that clinicians consider doing imaging. And then you bring up the point that the imaging could potentially be hard to interpret given the fact that they may have chronic changes there or they may have had surgery to alleviate their back pain, and I do think that does present challenges. I think, as Mike, our neuroradiologist on the call with us today, has alluded to, there are plenty of patients that have had negative MRI scanning done earlier post-injection that then go on to develop a positive MRI finding. And so we are cautious to say that if there is an abnormality on MRI at that site of injection, it should be closely evaluated, and I think a low threshold to consider that it might actually be relevant and be part of an infectious process. I want to just give Mike a chance to respond specifically to the MRI issue. Mike?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I think in regards to the question, absolutely, history is vital. And I don't mean exposure history, but I mean where they were injected and which side and which level. And often, again, these are very subtle findings. There may be, you know, things ranging from, you know, a little, you know, more enhancement than what we expect. But if we hear and if we find out that they've been injected at that level, we tend to be very cautious. And our only tool, like I alluded to earlier, was temporal imaging. In other words, getting a follow-up to see if that area in question evolves into something more obvious. And I think that's how you need to approach the MRI, with caution, with a low threshold, a high sensitivity, and with clinical correlation as to where they were injected, and then finally using temporal imaging, follow-up imaging, to see if that finding is real or not.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate that. And thank you for the questions. Why don't we queue up another phone, but in the meantime, we will read a quick internet question and address that. Ray?
All right. What is your experience with deaths associated with these injections? How many? And do you always request an autopsy on such cases? And finally, are the autopsies performed as hospital cases or within the realm of the medical death investigation system, so the coroner or medical examiner?
Yeah, thanks for that question. To date, I believe we are at 39 deaths that are associated with this outbreak. I think the important thing to point out about deaths, as I just mentioned, the outbreak has sort of been in these three phases as I look back. And the first phase was clearly very severe disease. Most deaths occurred from patients that were diagnosed or identified early in the outbreak that had very severe meningitis or complications thereof, many of which developed strokes. And so it appears that the vast majority of deaths occurred early in the outbreak or as part of patients that were diagnosed early and were unable to be successfully treated for either their meningitis or a complication thereof, like stroke. I think that we are certainly encouraging these clinics and hospitals to perform autopsies. Many of them have been performed at the hospital themselves. I believe some of them have also been performed through the state and medical examiners. And we here at CDC are working with anyone who is willing to do an autopsy and are happy. Our pathology group here are happy to receive tissues, process them, and review them with local and state pathologists. So why don't we take a call now from the phone line?
Thank you. And once again, to ask a question on the phone, dial star then one. Our next question comes from David Kaufman. Your line's open.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? This is Dave Kaufman in New Jersey. Anu and Michael, thank you so much. That was very illuminating.
Dave, great.
We're here in New Jersey. I think our experience has been a little bit different, but maybe in the next 2 weeks it'll become more similar. So I had a bunch of questions. Tom knows I always do, so sorry about that. When you were looking, particularly when you talked about taking devices out of patients, did anybody ever consider PET scanning these people? Did you have any experience with that out of Michigan?
Mike, any comments?
Yeah, no, Dave, I don't have any experience with that. It's a good thought, you know. PET, as you know, was metabolic imaging, and it looks for glucose uptake, and, you know, I guess any infection would be, hypermetabolic or positive, if you will. But, again, it's probably not as specific. It's probably sensitive, but, no, I don't have any experience with that. That's a good thought, though.
Yeah, actually, when we started our outbreak, I wanted to kind of PET scan everybody as a research project, but nobody was happy about that. The other question I had, mostly for Anu and any other ID docs that are in, I'm not too smart, but I'm having trouble understanding the wisdom of using dual therapy for an extended period of time in these folks. So I'd kind of like some ideas on the rationale of that.
Sure.
Go ahead, Anu. I think I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts.
Sure, yeah, I can, and then you can add in, Tom. So, you know, I think some of the way we approached patients changed a little bit, probably towards the end of October, when maybe a little bit before that, when we started seeing a number of patients, mostly, you know, the first month of this outbreak was mostly folks with CNS meningitis. And then by, you know, weeks three or four, the third and fourth week in October, we were seeing a number of them to come back that were already home on oral voriconazole, coming back with, secondary processes at their epidural site. So we started treating all those people with combination therapy because, well, you know, it progressed on oral voriconazole. You know, was it failure to medical therapy or would it have just happened as a part of their disease? Maybe not fully clear. So we know that amphotericin or, you know, ambisome is fungicidal. We know that maybe voriconazole may be fungicidal at high doses. I think in the epidural and paraspinal cases, I think probably my own feeling is that the key there is probably, if you can, operative intervention probably really plays a large role. We figured, you know, and you're right, no one really knows, is one drug better than two drugs? You know, which drug should you use? Should you use ambisome as opposed to voriconazole? One thing is you know, if you use ambisome and they're only going to be here a week, well, then you have to start them on voriconazole. And as you know, a lot of people have difficulty probably tolerating voriconazole, especially initially with hallucinations and photopsia, et cetera. We kind of took an approach of using both drugs. They're here. I think surgical intervention is probably really something that plays a large role. And I can tell you our readmission rates from that group of patients, which is, you know, really the majority of disease we've seen in the last 6 to 7 weeks, it's nothing at all what it was like for the patients with meningitis. So. You know, so, I mean, I can't tell you that our way is the right way. I do think that surgery is very important and to engage your neurosurgeons and to have, we were fortunate to have kind of these multidisciplinary conferences with neurosurgery, neuroradiology, infectious disease, anesthesia, and really kind of talk about some of these cases, which I think, you know, we were seeing so many that it really kind of helped us to have some sort of I don't know if I should say standard, but maybe a uniformed approach for how we were
I think you're absolutely right. At our little community hospital, we've had the hospital set up a clinic where we see all these patients rather than try to scatter them throughout anybody's office day or whatever. And I think it has helped. And we've had
David,
a dedicated team in Yak Yak and blah, blah.
And David, I'll comment. This is, and again, thanks for calling in. It's good to hear your voice. Just to comment on the dual therapy aspect, I mean, I agree, you know, we're on untreaded ground here a bit, and I think that in CDC's guidance, we still continue to recommend consideration for dual therapy in people that have new findings or worsening or have very severe disease. And I think there is some rationale in the antifungal world where dual therapy may be better than monotherapy in some particular cases, hitting it at different different sites, different targets, the cidal versus the static effect of azoles versus the polyenes, and just maybe hitting the infection hard at the beginning. I think that the real challenge, as Anu pointed out, is that there are these patients that progressed. These patients that progressed on drugs, it's unclear to us whether that was simply already happening and whether that was a failure of monotherapy or whether giving them more dual therapy up front might have stopped some of that progression. And here's the challenge that we're sort of faced with. We know that these people got injections with steroids, and we know on many of the pathology slides that we've looked at, there was minimal to almost no inflammation in some of those epidural spaces around the fungi, which of course would lead to minimal or no symptoms at the site, and also minimal or if not no findings on MRI or imaging where you need some sort of inflammatory reaction for that to be present. So some of the thoughts are that a lot of these the epidural and localized infections that accompanied the meningitis that showed up later might have already been there or might have already been established because the fungi were already invading, but there just wasn't the time for the body to respond to it. So I think that the dual therapy question is still a challenging one. I think we've heard from clinicians that are treating a lot of these people, you know, like yourself, that some of them have opted for dual therapy in some initial settings for a certain period of time and then have been transitioning to voriconazole.
So one last question, I hope. When you guys have gotten your pathology on your localized infections, has there been any sign of vasoinvasion? Just out of curiosity.
You said signs of what again?
Blood vessel invasion.
Yes. Yeah, so on, and I think we've tried to post some images now on our website of pathology. But what we've seen in pathology sections and in slides with our pathologists here at CDC is we have seen angioinvasion. We have seen evidence of hematogenous spread, but only in the posterior circulation. So it doesn't seem to be a systemic hematogenous spread, but just within the posterior circulation of the CNS, and pretty robust vasculitis, as well as subarachnoid hemorrhage, et cetera. And you can, I think if you go, anyone go to the website, we have a pathology page, and I believe there are representative images of some of these different conditions and disease states on the web.
And Tom, I would also add on imaging and radiology, we have noted, angioinvasive mycotic aneurysms of the basilar artery. They're almost a centimeter to centimeter and a half in size. So clearly angioinvasive. Unfortunately, that patient did die. She did have basilar strokes as well.
Thank you. David, one more question, then we got to let some other people. Are you done?
I'm done.
Oh, fantastic, David. Thanks for joining. Good to hear your voice.
Best thing you've heard from me, I know.
Why don't we queue up another phone question, and in the meantime, we'll do an Internet question, right?
All right. Can we use itraconazole if the patient does not have intradural collections, as they are having trouble tolerating vori and ampho?
Yeah, thanks for this question, and we clearly get and have gotten these questions a lot about alternative therapies if vori and ampho are not are causing too much toxicity. I know Anu has a little bit of experience with itraconazole, so Anu, I'll let you address this one.
Sure, I think if they don't have CSF involvement, they don't have meningitis. It's probably okay to use itraconazole. I guess, it depends on the ones with the epidural infections and how much epidural involvement there is. I think, I have a couple patients that have sacroiliac osteomyelitis that have, ankle-related infection. And I even, this week, was on the fence about switching someone with vertebral osteomyelitis to itraconazole. She did have a little bit of a rash, and I've just been kind of watching her on voriconazole. But I think the criteria for switching really is going to depend on whether or not they have CSF involvement and, how much epidural space involvement they have. Because clearly, voriconazole does get into the CSF. my own experience, I think, not many patients I have on itraconazole, but in those patients, they really couldn't tolerate voriconazole, and they all seem to be doing fine on itraconazole. I think we have about three patients thus far on itraconazole. And we've used itraconazole over posaconazole just because of the more frequency of dosing and absorption issues with posaconazole.
Thanks, Anu. And I just to comment on posaconazole, I think that there are a few people using it out there. It is available, as you all know, as oral solution only. The MICs for posaconazole are very low. It's a drug that gets actually really good tissue levels in the CNS, although it's not known necessarily yet as a CNS drug. I think the we still are learning about posaconazole, and as Anu mentioned, there are issues with dosing and absorption that one needs to consider. So I think it could remain a second or third line drug if needed, and certainly can be considered along with the itraconazole. And just to address susceptibility, since I brought it up, we have now posted susceptibilities for the Xerohilum organisms that we've tested here at CDC. They are on the web, and we continue to test more isolates as they come in. So if for anyone's information, although we can't interpret these MICs yet, because we have no idea about breakpoints per se, you can get a look at the MICs on our website. So please visit CDC's website to see the minimum inhibitory concentrations for the drug. I think we're getting on to the hour and 15 minutes, and I think Anu and Mike both have clinical patients to see, and so we thought we'd cut this off here in the next minute or two. We could take one more question from the phone, and then maybe try to do a couple more internet questions. Can we take one more from the phone?
We have no questions in queue over the phone.
Okay, perfect. Then maybe we're at the perfect time to stop. So, again, thanks, everybody, for joining today. Please tell your colleagues. This will be on our website, and you will be able to watch the slide presentations and then hear some of the questions and answers, or your colleagues will. Please let them know. I want to thank Anu and Mike and Ray and everybody else who helped organize this webinar. Hope everyone has a happy holidays and a happy new year. Thanks for joining.
And this concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.